The intensity in her eyes quieted slowly, like the embers of a fireplace, leaving only a tired ranger. She slumped.
Does that make any sense?
I don't know, Gallio thought. I don't know!
Were Inquisitors supposed to be this full of doubts? Had the heroes of old, the ones of flesh and blood, always wondered if the step they took was the right one? It couldn't be. Nothing would ever get done if good people were as unsure of themselves as Gallio was. Dungeon lords would crush them easily, since dungeon lords never faltered. The last time that Gallio's faith had swayed, people had died, and he'd lost Alita's favor. He knew the answer Alvedra expected, the one he should give. Of course she was right. Evil should be burned from the world. Whatever Alvedra told herself as a motivation would do. But Gallio also knew that Alita wasn't famous for her mercy. Cruel Golden Bitch was one of the many nicknames the Lotians had for her, and they, may the light forgive him, weren't entirely wrong. She was unforgiving because she had to be, of course. Giving an inch to the dark, allowing doubt and fear to stay her hand, would mean losing Ivalis to eternal night. Even if Alvedra killed Edward Wright and released Kess's soul to receive Alita's judgment, Gallio had little doubt what the sentence would be.
And if I tell her that, what will it achieve? She still has her duty.
What did the tenet say about white lies? He was sure that speaking the truth had to be somewhere in there.
I don't know if it makes sense,
Gallio told her, hating himself for his cowardice.
I'm but a mortal, and cannot speak for the goddess. I can only do my duty as best as I can.
My duty, right.
Gallio could see her holding on to his words like a drowning woman to a log.
You are right, of course. I shall do my duty above all else. Thank you, Gallio. I needed to hear that. Here, there's something you need to see.
There is something wrong with this,
Gallio thought, as Alvedra rummaged through her pockets again. There was something he had missed, some meaning he'd mangled. He'd done something wrong, even if he'd aligned with the tenets. How could that even be? But Alvedra was already moving forward, drawing confidence from Gallio's hollow assurances. She produced a small wooden tube and showed it to him.
Remember this?
It was the dart that the Kufdar had used to put her to sleep.
Nasty concoction,
Gallio said, while wondering on the inside what that had to do with anything.
You kept it?
More like it hitched a ride on my neck while I was being dragged to safety,
she explained.
As a ranger, I was taught that if you're bitten by a snake, you should try to capture that snake and bring it with you to a healer.
She held the dart between her fingertips and raised it above her head.
I think that, in my dazed state, I thought this was somehow like being bitten by a snake, so I held on to it.
Was it any use to the clerics?
No,
Alvedra said with a dismissive wave.
Not at all. But after I had time to clear my mind, I realized I recognize it.
Gallio tilted his head as he processed Alvedra's words.
Recognize it?
I'm a ranger,
she said simply.
This is my country, and I spent most of my life around these lands. Kufdar clans are nomadic, but they move in cycles. This clan, I've met them twice before.
She gestured at Gallio to grab the dart.
See those markings over there? Vaguely resembling crossed scimitars if there's good light. It's the symbol of the Haga Anashi. It means Raven Top's Grudge in Heiligian, which is what I called them. Way easier to pronounce, if you ask me.
What does their name mean?
Beats me. Most likely werewolves ate their grandparents because they are mean monster hunters, and they're damn good at it. Cities and villagers hire them to clear rotface infestations, or acid blobs breeding in dank cellars. Perhaps find some rabid pixies down a well. There are rumors, though, that they work for dungeon lords, too. They help them collect monsters for their defenses, their experiments, or their personal collections. I guess the rumors were right this time.
Gallio nodded, studying the crisscrossed, serrated slashes that were the symbol of the grudge.
"It seems that way, yes. Do you think they recognized you?"
Alvedra shook her head.
"First time I met them, I was a kid. They came to Barova and got rid of a nasty group of harpies that had been eating the livestock."
"Harpies? I'd no idea there were harpies around Constantina."
"There aren't any now."
Alvedra retrieved the dart and pocketed it.
"Second time, I was an apprentice ranger. Our master brought cousin Ione and I to the Haga Anashi campsite. A dungeon lord had died in the marshes near our territories. A couple cockatrices escaped from his dungeon, and it was nearing their mating season. They were too dangerous to hunt alone, so our master hired a squad of monster hunters to find them and deal with them before they could multiply and ruin the local ecology."
"They sound very useful, those Kaftar,"
Gallio thought. It was the sort of duty an Inquisitor should do if they hadn't been all so occupied dealing with their own infighting.
"Their chieftain was Kagelshire, or something like that. Judging from the spotting on his fur, I would bet my bow the Kaftar that dosed me was Kagelshire's son or nephew. You know what that means?"
"It means the clan won't be too far from Wright's dungeon,"
Gallio said. He could feel his eyes go wide. Alvedra was right. This was big. The sort of thing they should bring to their superiors immediately. If they got a lead on Wright's main dungeon, they could deal with him in a single blow. With one well-targeted spell to disable any portals, and Wright's story may come to an end. Gallio's blood froze in his veins. Yes, Wright's story would end. But so would the story of all of Barova's villagers he'd saved because of Ione's betrayal.
"Only if he didn't send them away," Gallio thought desperately. "He promised he'd free them in the neighboring villages."
But he knew how much a dungeon lord's word was worth, didn't he? How could he have been so foolish? There was no doubt in his mind that Wright had kept as many innocent villagers as possible in his dungeon, a safety net to prevent Gallio from prying too hard. Not that it'd change a thing. When they first met, Gallio was but a sheriff. Today, he was an inquisitor. His duty was perfectly clear. Wasn't that what he'd told Alvedra only an instant ago? He'd played himself.
"Lita, have mercy on my soul,"
he pleaded in a whisper.
"What did you say?"
Alvedra asked. It was eerie, to think that the death of so many could be decided in the middle of a garden full of life.
"Let's hope that Inquisitor Oak is up to the task,"
Gallio said. He walked away all of a sudden, forcing Alvedra to jog to catch up with him. He was eager to get to a place with hard floor under his boots. Suddenly, he couldn't stand the sight of the garden. Chapter 15. Yarlan. Yarlan of the Hidden Catacombs. Species, Elf, Nightshade. Essence, 73 years since conversion. Attributes, Brawn, 18. Minus 6 for cursed form. Agility, 17. Minus 6 for cursed form. Endurance, 18. Minus 6 for cursed form. Mind, 13. Spirit, 10. Charm, 8. Skills. Combat casting. Advanced, 2. Pertains to the speed and efficiency of spells cast during combat or life-threatening situations. Basic status allows the caster to use spells as quickly as their body can sustain. The caster must perform the appropriate hand gestures. Melee. Basic, 4. Temporal skill. Can become trained or be improved to open the brawling branch. Stalking. Improved, 3. Stealth tree branch. The owner knows how to move without being detected. Knowledge. Anatomy. Improved, 4. Knowledge. Ancient history, Lotian. Improved, 7. Candlemaking. Basic, 9. Taxidermy. Advanced, 5. Leadership. Basic, 6. Essence talents. Nightshade, Heart of the Mist, Vampiric Endurance, Vampiric Regeneration, Hypnotic Gaze, Compel Critters, Blood Potency, Mist Shape, Creature of the Night, Enhanced Thrall. While studying Yarlin's character sheet, Ed couldn't help feeling like an archaeologist looking at an ancient parchment recently unearthed. Even the format of the sheet looked outdated, and the list of skills she'd picked up somewhere along the way was too big to list, even if undead learned skills at a very reduced rate. The interrogation was interrupted by the incoming sunrise, at which point Yarlin was forced to go back to her coffin. Ed and the others left her there and spent the day sorting out the loot they'd earned from the pillage of the Inquisition wagons. After that, Kess ran so many security drills in the early morning that everyone had their nerves on edge by supper, enough so that a woman jumped under a table when a Batblin dropped a spoon next to her seat. Priest Zachary made bank selling polished brass trinkets he'd crafted earlier that day to the nervous haunt citizens, swearing the charms were anointed by Oinus and that they'd protect them against vampire bites and hypnosis. When Levy heard about it, she confiscated both the trinkets and the prophet. Ed went to sleep early, right after supper, and had his drone butler wake him up before midnight. He met his friends at the entrance of the mortuary, and together they headed inside to finish the interrogation. Yarlin was already waiting for them, sitting on her coffin, her legs dangling from its edge. She looked emaciated and, as she spoke, wouldn't stop staring at Alder's neck, much to the bard's dismay. The vampire had been 50-something when she was alive, the elven equivalent of her mid-30s. She'd been a vampire for longer than that, and in total she was almost 100 and a half years old. She'd lived in Lothia while it was still a kingdom not unlike Haleges, but when it had been ruled by the cadre of the dungeon lords of old. She had lived through the revolution that became, after years of bloodshed and chaos, the seeds of modern Lothia, a group of warring city-states which barely tolerated one another if they weren't openly fighting amongst themselves, all of them tied to the netherworld and the worship of Murmur. The modern Lothian dungeon lords lived in the no-man's land between the cities, fighting everyone, themselves most of all, but also the city's armies, and roving bands of heroes that the Inquisition summoned, at great cost for themselves, straight into Lothian territories. Ed himself had played the Evil Empire expansion of Ivalice Online. It had been the first ever DLC, right after the main storyline, which involved cleansing the Light Kingdom of all dungeon lord presence. In the expansion, Ed had scoured the rainy Lothian hilltops and marshes one boss at a time, racking up EXP by the thousands, hordes of monsters dying at the heels of his wizard as he launched endless blizzards of magical damnation at them. He'd left empty dungeons in his wake, destroyed netherworld detachments, and routed marauding mercenaries from the city-states. It was eerie to realize that, even before his arrival, he'd been an unaware player in Ivalice's current state of affairs. Hearing Yarlin speak arose in Ed a kind of hunger not unlike the one the vampire held for human blood. For a long time, he'd been painfully aware of how large his gaps in knowledge about his new world were. His access to history books was limited, and Staravos's records were mainly focused on its own history, most of which was oral, not written. The majority of those few books had been lost anyway, after Haleges had invaded the country and implanted a steel-clad hold on Staravosi libraries, most of which were in Galtia, the capital, whose palace was currently occupied by a Haligian princeling. Ed had had to buy a few black-market books through the Thieves' Guild. The fat tomes had been written by Elatron chroniclers and were stocked in the Haunt's library between Levy's witchcraft tomes and a few scrolls on monster biology that Kaga's clan had lent the Haunt. The Elatron books were biased toward Haleges and the militant church, but Ed hoped to unearth the truth by contrasting them against Yarlin's eyewitness account, and maybe find a sliver of truth in the middle.
"Don't think of her as a member of the Haunt just yet," he told himself.
He had little doubt that Yarlin was a monstrous creature, but the question was she the kind of monster that could be contained? Like the horned spiders. If she wasn't, she'd have to go, no matter how useful she was.
"Tell me about the heroes," he said.
A heavy tension filled the air. Kleck bent forward, his bat ears straightened in rapt attention. Yarlin squinted and pursed her lips.
As you wish,
she said simply.
It all began 15 years ago, around 834 in the old calendar, during the reign of King Verin the Fair in Heiliges and Count Bastivar in the free city of Yin. 834 was a good year. Plenty of easy prey with potent blood to increase your essence. I served under Dungeon Lord Yaraz the Old. Back then, the most recent Yaraz was but an apprentice, learning to create drones and carve holes in caves.
Her eyes glazed over as if remembering a particularly nice trip to the beach.
Archlord Everbleed hid in his tower, behaving as if the times of the ancient lordship hadn't died with the fall of Sephar. St. Clair and Tillman, meanwhile, plugged their ears and pretended their coffers hadn't dried up decades ago, bankrolling the fight against Bastivar and his revolution. Which was not a good time at all to be a vampire, let me tell you. There was always a risk you'd wake up and find that your mortal thralls had listened to too much propaganda during the daylight hours, and now you had a stake through your heart and your butler was building a pyre around you. But I digress. Year 834. Old Yaraz fought the marauding armies of the militant church all around the western Lothian frontier, while the Arpedel dynasty brought the fighting to Heligian shores, and the dungeon twins, Hinds and Vaines, roamed like a tornado past the black shores of Vros, leaving devastation in their wake. It was experience points and essence all around. You wouldn't believe how much fun I had. The rivers were awash with blood and mud and bodies, and necromancers could go for a stroll and stumble into a pile of bones as tall as their head, ready for raising. Such a great time to be undead.
Ed's mind raced as Yarlin spoke, trying to assemble important facts that she was merely throwing around and passing. As an afterthought, he summoned a drone by a corner and ordered him to transmute pen and parchment to take notes for later. There was a timeline to follow here, but history class had been one of his weaknesses back on Earth, and Yarlin wasn't making it easy. She was so old that she digressed constantly and changed decades in the middle of important points. He attempted to ground her words. First, there'd been the ancient lordship, which had lasted an indeterminate amount of time and had ended with Sephar's Bane, which had caused the Inquisition to reform into its current bloodthirsty form. Long after that, a revolution had ravaged Lothia, and Bastivar had kicked the last archlord into a tower somewhere. Lothia had split into free city-states, and then Heiliges invaded, and the dungeon lords invaded them back. But by the sounds of it, war between both countries was the normal state of affairs. Levy and Alder had been about 10 years old, Kess had been a soldier in the Cardinal Command, and Kleck hadn't been born yet. Ed himself had been in high school, an angry orphan living with his relatives and deciding between joining the military for the benefits or drowning in debt to study computer science.
No one paid much attention to the first hero. The militant church sent it against Lady Golsa, who destroyed it with little effort and thought nothing of it. There wasn't much to tell. After all, every spellcaster and their mother were trying to develop new tools to kill their enemies at a distance. I prefer up close and personal myself. But then a second hero came knocking at Golsa's doors, and a new one after that. And then they came in groups. And then people began paying attention. Minions of different dungeon lords talk among themselves, see? Mostly to keep an eye on working conditions, and experience points earned per year, and salaries and things like that. Eventually, everyone in the Netherworld knew about Golsa's situation. It was a joking matter at first. Golsa destroyed the heroes over and over again, and the militant church spent more gold building them than she did fighting them. Heroes were little more than expensive golems, and every aureus wasted on them was an aureus that wasn't going to sponsor real adventurers or inquisitors. Golsa outfitted her throne rooms and main halls with the destroyed constructs, and showed it to her friends at parties, bragging about how she'd defeated each specific instance. Not unlike a Kaftar big game hunter. She made everyone jealous. But not for long. each iteration of the heroes had some new improvement, and in hindsight, the militant church chose their first target perfectly. Golsa lacked Vane's military genius, or the Arpedel's bravery, or Yorick's insane charm build. Golsa began losing ground more and more with each battle. The heroes now carried an assortment of runes and could activate them by themselves, which no golem before them could have done. And they wielded enchanted weapons and armor designed for sentient hands, on top of layers upon layers of enchantments on their own bodies. Golsa lost minions in droves. Some to the heroes, but most because they saw the writing on the wall, ended their pacts, and snuck off to the nearest netherworld portal to find some new dungeon lord. Allies of Golsa aided her at first, but the heroes never stopped coming, and eventually she ran out of goodwill. She lost her outposts first, then her resource dungeons, then her inner dungeons, and then she took refuge in the netherworld. I think the old crone is still hiding there.
The drone scribbled as fast as it could, its pointed tongue protruding from its lips. Alder looked at its writings, shook his head, and took the parchment and pen away from it, then began writing himself, scratching and amending at the same time he followed Yarlan's tale.
So, they didn't kill Golsa?
Levy asked. She massaged her chin.
My mentor, Warlock Chazen, mentioned her once or twice. He was one of the minions that left her when things grew dire. He always wondered what wound up happening to her.
I'm glad to help put that mystery to rest,
Yarlan told her, giving a fake smile.
After Golsa, the militant church sent heroes against other dungeon lords, and her tale was repeated over and over again. It didn't matter how smart or strong or rich a lord was. The damn constructs just kept coming. Most lords simply escaped into the netherworld like Golsa had done. But eventually, the heroes developed a spell that could neutralize a nearby portal. Think Murmur, the spell still has a low success rate. But luck doesn't last forever.
She drew an imaginary line in the air with a long yellow nail.
When the first dungeon lord fell, hunted inside his own dungeon like a rabbit, things got out of control. A new version of the heroes appeared, with capabilities far beyond the previous iterations. This new hero needs no runes to cast spells. Even worse, they are able to grow in power, much like a living being can gain experience points. Many dungeon lords met their demise while trying to distract the heroes by creating disposable dungeons to keep them occupied, only to have the heroes grow into unstoppable killing engines. I believe this was the fate of the last of the Arpedels.
Ed gave Levy a concerned gaze. His friend's expression was distant.
Yes, it was,
she told the vampire.
Glad to put that mystery to rest.
Yarlan nodded, unaware or uncaring of the witch's turmoil.
Enough with the history lesson,
Kes said.
How do you put them down?
Like you would any other golem, I guess,
Yarlan said with a shrug.
You can inflict overwhelming damage that renders them useless, or bypass their magical defenses and melt their inner workings. Anti-magic circles leave them unable to cast spells, and powerful magical afflictions, like fear, blindness, and silences, can affect them much like any living creature, but not for long. Thing is, they are much more resilient than any mortal. And even if you deal with them, a new heroic batch will come. And there are less minions this time around, so even if you win...
She drew a downward spiral with her hand to underline her words.
All spells can be countered,
Levy said, raising an eyebrow.
How come no one has ever captured the hero, cut it open, and figured out how it works?
Do you think no one else has thought of that, little witch?
Yarlan snapped at her.
Of course we've tried. The damn things either teleport away or explode when they're beaten. By Murmur, they off themselves even if you freeze one with ice magic. Some dungeon lords dug into Golsa's ruins and found some of her early captured heroes. They didn't explode back then. They were just golems, nothing special about those, except that they had expensive remote-controlling enchantments installed. No, The newer versions are something else. But we cannot force rubble to share its secrets.
Yarlin bared her fangs in frustration. Ed ignored the vampire's outburst. Something in her description had set his imagination off, and now he could barely pay any attention to her. She'd said something before, something about him, the first time they'd met, but her exact words had eluded him. He felt as if he were standing next to one huge realization, like a detective that passes next to the unrevealed killer and tenses up, his instincts picking something up, but not yet knowing.
"You told us that they could grow," he told the vampire. "Do you know how?"
"Oh, most minions have seen it in action, even if they don't live long enough to tell the tale. Of course, I'm the exception. When a modern hero destroys a throne room, something interesting happens. Don't worry, Lord Wraith, I fear you'll know what I'm talking about very soon. The entire dungeon melts as if made of a nightshade's mist. Afterward, the hero becomes much stronger, as do their weapons and armor. It seems as if they feed on the dungeon, somehow, although I don't know how that is possible, and if any remaining dungeon lord knows the procedure, they've kept it to themselves.
She smoothed a crease in her black dress and turned to Ed.
You know about as much as I do, Lord Wraith. To end my story, Yiraz the Young killed Yiraz the Old and came to Starevos, following the rumors of an otherworldly dungeon lord. A weapon designed by Murmur as an answer to the Inquisition's constructs. I believe Yiraz half hoped, half feared, that you would be an artificial creature, not unlike the heroes. I don't know how he would have felt about the truth. If you allow me to be honest, I don't see any powers or skills you may have that will allow you to succeed where every other lord has failed.
I really wish I had one, Ed thought. In many of his favorite games, the player character had a power that set them well beyond the level of their enemies, allowing them to tear through unending hordes of mooks. Life, though, didn't work that way. Ed already had powers that set him well apart from the rest of humanity, those of an ordinary dungeon lord. Those powers hadn't been enough in the past. Ed's duty was to protect those under his care, and then when raw magical power wasn't enough, he'd have to fill the gaps with ingenuity and determination. And right then, he remembered Yarlin's words.
The otherworldly dungeon lord. A move taken straight from the Light's playbook.
Associations flared in his mind like fireworks, one after the other. The heroes self-destructing when defeated, the mechanism to feed on a dungeon, golems controlled from afar. His suspicions grew upon realization after realization and became certainty. He gave Yarlin a slanted grin.
Back where I come from, knowledge is power, and you've already told me something that I don't think many dungeon lords know.
Yes? And what's that?
Yarlin asked, tilting her head like a predator sniffing the air for signs of danger.
The militant church didn't create the heroes, Ed said. Someone from my world did.
Next to him, Alder inhaled sharply, and his pen scratched a line on the parchment.
Thanks, Yarlin. You've given us much to think about. I'd say that's enough for one night. Tomorrow, we'll talk about your fate.
Later that night, Ed and his friends sat in the war room, their faces heavy with sleep. Amphorus's leg cast long shadows across the table, which was strewn with untouched snacks.
Are you sure?
Kes asked Ed, while he glanced at Alder's notes.
Almost, Ed said. It only makes sense. The way she spoke about it, Alita has been summoning people from other worlds before Murmur brought me to Ivalus.
He looked at Alder for confirmation, but the bard shrugged apologetically.
The militant church doesn't tell Alita all their plans, Alder explained. Even if they did, I wasn't far enough in my training to be worth the trust of such a secret. There are mentions of strange adventurers brought from distant lands to serve the Light in the war against the ancient lordship, but those records are ancient, Id, and distant lands may have simply meant another continent, like Plex.
Ed nodded.
What about you, Levy? Did Kale or Hines ever mention anything about their grandfathers fighting strangers?
Their grandfathers?
Levy chuckled softly.
I think both Aldor and that vampire bitch failed to explain the expanse of time we're talking about when we speak of ye olden days, Ed. Simply put, the creation of the first Dungeon Lord is year zero in the old calendar.
Oh, Ed said. What year are we in again?
850.
Ed thought of his timeline.
I'm going to need more parchment, he realized in dismay. I see, he said. But there are other details that point at someone from Earth being behind the heroes.
He scratched his hair, trying once again to speak of terms like data security protocols and digital rights management that had no easy counterpart in a world where magic had kept an industrial revolution from happening. Then Ed realized that maybe there was a counterpart after all.
Okay, tell me, what happens when a wizard wants to sell a new spell? There has to be a way to stop someone from buying the spellbook, then copying it for free and spreading it around, right?
It was a bit of a leap to think that Ivalis had an equivalent of a patent office, but Ed already knew that there were a few spells that everyone could learn, like Ice Bolt or Fireball, and others that could only be obtained by studying the appropriate spellbook. Levy rested her back against the wall.
You're thinking of metamagic. Extremely advanced theory. Metamages are specialists that spend most of their lives studying the science of casting spells that modify other spells. When, say, Wizard Bob develops a fireball variant, he brings his spell notes to a metamage, who will imbue the notes with a custom metaspell. Thanks to this, Bob's notes cannot be copied or reproduced without his permission, and cannot even be comprehended unless you bought the notes from Bob himself, or an approved spell shop. If you do buy Bob's fireball, then you can understand the spell and cast it. But you cannot teach it to others. Unless you buy more copies, of course.
Ed's fingertips tingled with excitement, even the ones of his skeletal hands. At last, he'd found something where he held the undeniable home advantage, a situation where he wasn't racing after the knowledge that everyone else in Ivalis already had. DRM was something he knew well. He'd earned the damn degree that proved it.
And you can dispel those metaspells, can't you? He asked.
If you manage to get a hold of the same mage or one who's more powerful. But it's usually cheaper just to buy the spell note. If you don't have the money, there are seedy parts of the Netherworld that deal in unprotected notes that are cheaper. These spells are lesser quality imitations of the original. But if you have a keen eye, you can sometimes find a spell that works just as well as the expensive version. My own Crow Familiar is one of those.
This is all very interesting,
Kes said dryly.
But I fail to see what it has to do with the heroes, Ed.
Ed nodded gratefully at Levy before turning back to Kes.
See, we have the same metamagic in my world. We call it DRM, but we use it for software. Software is like a spell note that isn't magical and works only as information. I know the hero's creator came from Earth because there people have also tried to add metamagical protection to advanced military weapons.
What, like enchanting a sword to prevent anyone from making a similar one?
Kes asked, raising an eyebrow.
How could you even enforce such a thing? The Cardinal Command has its secrets, like our flight formations. But it's not like we could treat knowledge itself as a spell and add metamagic to it. I don't need to be a witch to know objectivity would eat anyone who tried.
She's right,
Levy said. Well, Earth has no objectivity, Ed pointed out. There's also no magic, so people have to get creative.
He remembered his first meeting with Charon, back when the boatman had told him that Murmur had summoned Ed because people from Earth had a different perspective than the people from Ivalis.
A guy from Earth that wants to stop dungeon lords from capturing his heroes and studying them won't think about something as Ivalian as metamagic. He'll just enchant his designs to blow up if they fall into enemy hands. Problem solved.
He watched as understanding lit his friends' faces.
Heroes are protected in the way a person from Earth would choose instead of an Ivalian spellcaster,
Levy said.
So, the Inquisition has its own Lord Ed?
Kleck asked quietly.
I guess that's one way to put it, Ed said. More like, They have an Ed with 15-plus years of a head start, with all the resources of the militant church at his disposal, and who probably was in the military before being summoned.
Wetlands, we're fucked!
Levy said, suddenly having gone pale.
This explains so much.
Trust me, it could have been worse, Ed told her. And he meant it. We should be glad the light was so naive when they summoned him. They probably used a spell that looked for a powerful war mage, and it got them the closest thing, a military software developer. Had they known what to look for, Ed shuddered. If the light had summoned a biologist, or a nuclear physicist, a bioengineered plague or a fucking nuke were bad enough on Earth, but if they were mixed with magic, the consequences could be cataclysmic. He wondered if objectivity could save Ivalis from becoming a molten, radioactive ball. Hell, the Dark was very lucky that this mysterious developer had only sent heroes after it. Ed himself had already come up with several ideas about mixing magic with basic programming principles, with 15 years and a country's resources at his disposal. How come the light hasn't steamrolled Murmur already? Ed thought. There was something there that didn't make sense. Whatever the reason, he decided the Haunt couldn't possibly bank on this streak of good luck to continue.
I hate to say this, but we need to talk to the Lothian Dungeon Lords, and quick.
I'm not looking forward to that,
Levy said.
Most of the Lothians are murderous bastards that sacrifice people to increase their power. I know there are less bloodthirsty dungeon lords hiding all over the world. Kale's minions got notice of them dying all the time. Perhaps we could talk to them instead.
I'd like that too, Ed told her. But one way or the other, all dungeon lords step into the netherworld eventually. That's where we go next.
Then you're in luck,
Levy said after a crestfallen sigh.
Yarlan's our best bet to reach one of the few civilized parts of the Netherworld.
Yarlan,
Kes said wearily.
It was about time we discussed what to do with her.
Ed nodded. Deciding what to do with the vampire would be crucial.
What do you all think?
I don't like her, Kleck said, shivering. The way she looks at us, wolves look at batblins the same way before they pounce. I don't think we could be safe with her around. She may eat us in our sleep.
That's what pact magic is for, Ed pointed out. In fact, binding Yarlan with a pact may be the safest bet for everyone, not only the Haunt.
The safest bet will be to kill her,
Kes said, patting her silver-tipped stake.
She's a bloodthirsty monster who wouldn't give much thought to devouring us if she were in our place.
Yes, I know that, Ed said. But we could say the same about the horned spiders. And yet here we are, working with them.
Levy raised an eyebrow.
Surely you don't think a vampire and a horned spider are even close to being the same thing. I don't get it, Ed. Back there, in the mortuary, you were all up for killing her at the first sign of trouble.
And a few days ago, you were all up for a nightshade in the Haunt, Ed told her, waving with his hand and grinning slightly. Look, it's true I don't like her. I doubt anyone here does, actually. But she's our prisoner. I can't kill her because I dislike her. That'd be a Rylan Silverblade move.
Who?
Alder asked. Ed shook his head.
It's just some asshole. Never mind. My point is, we should think this through. Not for her, but for ourselves.
His friends mulled over his words, although begrudgingly.
I guess we could use her knowledge, Alder said. I mean, she's as biased as she claims bards are, but still, she's like a walking history book.
Forget her knowledge,
Levy said.
She knows how to enter the Netherworld, remember? She was a dungeon lord's second in command. We can use her to create a portal to one of the main cities, and we need the Netherworld, Ed. You cannot go around with that weakness to light magic, or you'll become a charred husk the second some cleric sneezes your way.
Thanks for the mental image, Ed told the witch.
But she was right. The problem with the Netherworld was that it was a pretty big place, from what he'd heard. He could make a portal right then, since he had the materials and the gold, but he lacked coordinates, and without them, The portal could send them anywhere in the Netherworld, and the demonic monsters that roamed there would make a mere vampire blush. After all, the Netherworld-based St. Clair and Tillman thought of hell chickens as snacks.
"It's the kind of place where it's better to bring a guide," Ed thought.
Kes grimaced while she distractedly toyed with her steak.
"If we see her only as a tool for the haunt, her powers could be a nice addition. An undead can't be mind-controlled through normal means, or put to sleep, or poisoned. She could plug several weaknesses we have."
Something cruel glinted in her eye.
"The Inquisition will take her presence as more proof that we're evil. Not that they needed proof before."
It was clear that she was thinking of Alvedra.
"Screw it. If we're to be guilty, we may as well commit the crime."
Ed gave her a worried look. Of the others, only Alder seemed to notice the Marshal's inner turmoil. The bard bit his lip and turned to Kes, but Kleck spoke up.
"If there's going to be a wolf in the haunt," the Batblin said, "it should be shackled. Our spiders are loyal to their pack, like Batblins. We have common ground. Yarlin has no pack, so she needs a shackle she cannot break."
They kept the discussion going for a while. Eventually, they circled back to the same points and realized they were getting tired. Their next course of action was clear. After securing Yarlin, they'd go to the Netherworld and investigate. Then Ed would figure out a way to capture a hero, bypass the self-destruct mechanism, and see just what the construct was made of that allowed it to absorb the strength of a dungeon and act as a living creature. Ed massaged his legs, trying to ease circulation back into them. Studying a hero would, hopefully, show him its weaknesses. But that was only part of it. Ed didn't care about eradicating the heroes. After all, most dungeon lords were murderous, self-admitted tyrants that delved in human sacrifice. Perhaps the Inquisition and them deserved each other.
"We leave them to their war," Ed thought, "as long as they leave us alone."
But there was also the unknown person from Earth who had created the heroes in the first place. Ed knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that he needed to find that person. He needed to show him, make him understand, that the light was as extreme in its methods as the dark. Ed bit his lip and realized he'd been holding his breath.
"Who the hell are you?"
How long had that person, the first hero, in a way, been out there? What lies had the Inquisition made him believe? The desire to speak to that summoned hero was overwhelming. Perhaps, together, they'd be strong enough to oppose the mad gods that ruled Ivalis with an iron fist.
"How's that for a win condition?" Ed thought.
"Before we leave,"
Kleck said, jerking Ed out of his daydream,
"I'm curious. What happened before the old calendar started? There had to be something before the Lordship. Had to, right? The world wasn't just a blank canvas until the first Dungeon Lord came along."
For some reason, there was an eagerness in Kleck's eyes that made Ed think the answer may have been more important to the Batblin than he let on. Levy patted Kleck on the shoulder.
"Same old, little guy, same old. People being born, then growing, eating, fucking, dying, and killing each other since the dawn of time. The only difference was, back then they did it with weaker weapons. Probably made of bronze, I'd say. Stone before that."
Kleck looked down. Alder chuckled and said,
"That's one cynical way to talk about the past, Levy." "Don't mind her, Kleck. Some people just don't have the right temperament to study history. They get stuck in the ugly part and fail to see the pretty sunsets. Before the Lordship was the age of myths, my friend. An epoch without equal, that us bards can only dream about. It was a time of legends, of titans and dragon kings, and of the clash between them that altered the shape of continents."
Ed blinked, then stared at Alder, eyes round like dishes, wondering if he'd just heard what he thought he had. By the looks of it, Kleck was as stunned as he was. Meanwhile, Levy stared daggers at Alder.
"Don't act like those ancient Heligian folktales have any basis in reality, Alder. You will only confuse Kleck. And let me tell you where you can stick your pretty sunsets."
Kleck turned to Ed, smiling broadly.
"Did you hear that?
he asked quietly.
Dragons, Lord Ed. Can you imagine that?
Yes, Ed said, smiling back. Somehow, it was relaxing to know that no matter how important and world-breaking seemed the events that involved him and his haunt, they were still a mere blip in the scroll of history. Not long after, Ed and the others faced the vampire. This time, Ed explained the terms of his pact offer to Yarlin. She listened, growing more and more discomfited with each demand. Ed spoke for a long time. Then Yarlin couldn't take it any longer.
"Would you have me starve?"
she interrupted, raising her voice.
"I've dealt with strict terms to a pact before, Dungeon Lord, but yours are incomprehensibly tyrannical. If you were asking me not to feed on the humans in your dungeon's surroundings, I'd understand. Perhaps you need those humans for some scheme. But to not feed on anyone, anywhere?"
Ed forced himself to ignore the unease the vampire gave him. "Actually, you can't feed on any sentient species," he corrected her, adding emphasis to sentient because she'd used the word human instead. In Heiligian, which was the language that magically replaced Ed's English when he'd arrived on Ivalis, the word human could mean either human or any sentient species, like elf, dwarf, gnome, naga, kuftar, batblin, and along, etc. In his time in Ivalis, Ed had come to notice a few small other details like that, leftovers that the language-replacing spell had failed to correct. Normally, it earned him little more than a funny look when he said something in a strange phrasing. But in this case, Ed was absolutely certain that Yarlin had said human because she hoped to weasel her way into a more permissible diet.
"I can't sustain myself on animals alone!"
Yarlin exclaimed, raising her hands in disbelief. "You can't, or you don't want to," Ed prodded.
"Look, animal blood may keep me alive,"
she rolled her eyes at Alder's reaction to her phrasing,
"but I can't increase my essence with it. I can't earn experience points like a mortal. I need to drink the blood of mortals to grow in power. If I go too long without it, my essence will drain away. I'll eventually become as weak as a newly awakened nightshade. And what use will I be then?"
"So, drinking sentient blood is how you earn experience," Ed said. He massaged his chin and sighed. "Okay. Do you need to drink it from the living?" Ed was sure that at some point he'd gone insane without realizing it. He was casually suggesting defacing the dead because it was much better than exsanguinating some poor sod.
"Only if it's still warm,"
Yarlin said.
"Otherwise, it does nothing. Perhaps 5 to 10 minutes since the heart stopped beating."
"I can work with this," Ed thought. "Let's compromise, then. You can drink the blood of any fallen enemy of the haunt." Yarlin's expression brightened.
"That's much better, Lord Wraith."
"You can't, however," Ed went on, "kill an enemy solely to feed on them. You need a very good cause to kill someone. If they won't surrender, or if they're too dangerous."
"So now a dungeon lord has terms of engagement, like the damned cardinal command?"
Yarlin asked, her face souring again.
"By Murmur's non-existent compassion, what has the world come to?"
Ed turned to Kes. "How reasonable are the cardinal command's terms of engagement?" Kes tilted her hand a couple times in the universal gesture for, good enough, I guess." "Good enough for me. Yarlin, you'll follow the cardinal command's terms of engagement to see who you are allowed to kill." Yarlin rolled her eyes upward and launched into a long string of Lotian cursing. "I hope that isn't directed at me," Ed told her.
"I was praying to Murmur,"
Yarlin said when she was done. She cleaned a pinkish stream of saliva on her chin with her dress.
"I was begging him to torture Yraz's soul for convincing me to come to this stupid country only to die and leave me in your hands."
"Fair enough." From what Ed had heard of the distant Volantis Enclave, they were more reasonable than Haligis or Lotia. Using their army's rules would do, at least until the haunt drafted its own.
"At least I'll be able to hunt Minotaurs,"
Yarlin said, thoughtfully. Kes perked up at that,
Of course! You can kill as many of those bloodthirsty fuckers as you—
Actually, Ed hurried to say, with Minotaurs, you are to do what I— No, what Kleck would do in your shoes.
Why me?
Kleck asked, surprised at hearing his name. Because you may be the best of us, Ed thought. But he only smiled and shrugged.
Why?
Yarlin asked, her voice seeping with frustration.
If only I could understand your reasons. Why do you care about what I do in some random city 100 miles from here? Those people would sell you to the Inquisition in a heartbeat, Lord Wraith. To pretend to care about your subjects is mere politics. You need their goodwill to rule without distractions, true. But you gain nothing from this. Nothing at all.
Ed opened his mouth, then thought better of it. He had been about to go into a long tirade about basic human decency. But what was the point? Yarlin didn't care at all about that. In fact, she'd only lose respect for him as a dungeon lord if she thought he cared. No. To keep her under control, she needed to know he had a dungeon lord's reasons. You say that a dungeon lord may protect those living in his territories, to keep them pacified, Ed told the vampire. What about those living in lands he will control in the future? Wouldn't he wish to keep those people pacified too, so that when the time comes his rise to power is as smooth as possible? Yarlin mulled this over.
Interesting. Perhaps it even makes sense. I've heard of conniving dungeon lords who would charm their way into power rather than rely on brawn. And where would your ambitions lead you, Lord Wraith? What are the frontiers you are planning for your haunt? Will you be satisfied with Hoya and its surrounding villages? Maybe you're vying for Undercity itself, as well as its lands. What about Galtia with its belt of mountains? Maybe the frontiers of your future domains extend even further beyond, well past Strevos itself? Maybe Lothia should be worried about your ambitions. Maybe even Haligis. I hear the weather there is nice. For mortals.
Ed held the vampire's gaze.
Where will your ambitions lead you?
He asked himself. He wanted to face the light and the dark, force them to back away.
No, that's too simple. Too far away from you. What do you really want?
He wanted Galio to realize he didn't need the approval of the Inquisition to do good. He wanted Alvedra to realize that evil could fester anywhere, even in those donning golden armors and silver tunics. He wanted to show Ivalis that the light and the dark were the names that two warring groups of mad, godlike beings had given themselves. Nothing more, nothing less. But more than that, he wanted to prove to Murmur and Charon, and to himself more than anyone, that he could achieve everything without becoming Rylan Silverblade and all he'd come to represent in Ed's mind, even if it meant that Ed would risk becoming someone much worse. Simply put, when Ed looked deep inside himself, he found that this conflict was at the very core of his soul. It was who he was.
All those frontiers sound nice, Ed told Yarlin. To start with, at least.
Because right then and there, he'd decided that he'd welcome in anyone who would share his vision. Anyone who rebelled against becoming the plaything of Alita and Murmur. Anyone tired of the games of the light and the dark. Right now, the haunt was but a tiny hideout in the heart of a hostile countryside. But it was also more today than it had been before, back when Alder and Kleck and Levy and him were hiding in caves, barely surviving being eaten by spiderlings. Tomorrow, the haunt would be more, and one day, perhaps, if they all were strong enough and dedicated enough and had an enormous amount of luck, then the haunt would become strong enough to take on the light and the dark, and win. It was a fight worth fighting. Ed realized that he was smiling, and that he'd closed his hand into a resolute fist. He also realized that everyone in the mortuary was eyeing him strangely. It took him several seconds to understand why. He'd come across this discovery about himself, about his life's goal, when looking into the abyss of Yarlin's eyes, but no one else had heard his reasoning.
Ed's heart desire was.
I wish to save this world.
But what he'd said, instead, had been, I wish to rule this world. Two similar phrases, but with entirely different meanings. And which one was more real? Ed knew that, sometimes, the brain could deceive even itself in its rush to justify its selfish desires as righteous, and that the truth may show when the mind got careless. Which was the goal, and which the justification? Would he rule the world in order to save it, or would he save it only because he wished to rule it? It was as if the cold hand of a wraith, or his own black hand, for that matter, had reached through his chest to grip his heart. He'd faced creatures that would have given nightmares to the bravest of men. He'd bested the Mind Brood, and the Spider Queen, and the Wraith. But he had never understood Murmur's Gambit until now. He'd never stopped to consider that he had never had a chance of winning the gamble, because he'd lost it before it even began. Because, perhaps, the most abominable creature of them all wasn't a dungeon lord after all. When human could mean many things, all dungeon lords were humans, and that would mean that monsters were born and not made.
Ah.
Yarlin sighed. It seemed as if someone had lifted a heavy weight from her back.
Finally, I was wondering when would the Haunt's dungeon lord show his true self.
She gave him a smile more frightening than any of her previous threats and posturing. For this was a smile of genuine happiness.
I salute you, Lord Edward Wraith. I am Nightshade Yarlin of the Haunt, at your service.
And with those words, the pact was forged. Chapter 16. Character Creation. Lisa rummaged through the rows of cardboard boxes and plastic bags while doing her best to ignore the rat's squeaks coming from behind the plaster walls of the storage area.
It should be here, somewhere,
she told Omar. The new hire sported a brand new Laser Shark purple and pink vest, with the eponymous shark smiling at the center. His curly hair was pulled back into a tight bun and held together by a copious amount of gel. It was his third day on the job, and so far he'd done tolerably well.
Mr. Ryan was so kind lending me a laptop, Omar said.
Lisa fought back the urge to roll her eyes.
Sure,
she said.
Where is that damn thing?
She was sure she'd left it somewhere nearby. Perhaps past the stack of busted motherboards?
I mean, it's so cool, right? Omar went on. I never would have thought I'd get paid to play games on the job. It's the dream, isn't it?
Sure is.
She dug through a pile of faulty power supply units. The laptop wasn't there either. In the end, it wasn't Omar's fault that he wasn't able to read social cues, although that did little to comfort her. She could just tell him directly and be done with it, but that would mean having a long chat with Ryan, and or his aunt. And where would that leave her? Playing games on the job wasn't as cool as Omar hoped. First, the store still had to run, so Mark was doing the job of three people right now. Second, Lisa knew she'd need to stay for several extra hours to finish inventory, and she knew Ryan's thoughts on overtime. It was the kind of word a team player shouldn't even keep in their vocabulary. Third, she was sure Ryan only wanted Omar to get the hang of Ivalice online before the weekend, so Ryan wouldn't have to teach the newbie the ropes on his own. The laptop was half buried under a small mountain of black trash bags full of useless CDs that offered free antiviruses, free email accounts, and free trials of some corporate slideshow or spreadsheet processor.
Here you go,
Lisa said as she dusted the surface of the bulky thing with the back of her hand. The laptop was old and technically the property of the store, but its previous user had added a bit of personality to it with a couple stickers, one of a scantily clad elven wizard from a popular MMORPG, and another of a giant hulk of a demon that was the final boss in the same game. Omar grabbed the laptop almost reverently. Lisa found the charging cable inside one of the plastic bags and handed it to him as well. then stood and massaged her legs.
Hopefully it still works,
she said as they exited the storage area into a dusty hallway with naked wooden walls decorated.